Whether you find them on the backs of baseball cards or in the agate type of a newspaper box score, baseball statistics form a language of their own, complete with numerical icons, 56, 755, 368. There are fantastic players behind those numbers, but we wouldn't know them so well nor care so deeply about them without numbers keepers, grown men devoted to maintenance of the records of the game. One such number cruncher was Ernie Lanigan. He grew up in the late 1880s and made a career of his addiction to baseball statistics. Without records, Lanigan noted, we would have merely a series of exhibitions, meaningless after the game was over. They give permanency to the game, which it could never otherwise enjoy. Well, what was your first encounter with baseball statistics? Which numbers will always stand out in your mind for the stories they tell you about the game? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is our frequent guest on Baseball Matters, Alan Schwartz. He's a senior writer at Baseball America and author of the new book, The Numbers Game, Baseball's Lifelong Fascination with Statistics. He joins us from our bureau in New York. And welcome back, Alan.
Well, thank you, Neil. It's good to be here.
Statistics, I guess, are as old as the game itself. And you write a lot about a man who was a cricket reporter who found himself in Hoboken's Elysian Fields covering a newfangled game.
Well, yeah, baseball as we know it sort of today was born in 1845 when Alexander Cartwright delineated the first set of half-modern rules. And it wasn't long, it was about 10 or 15 years later, that Henry Chadwick, a cricket reporter for the New York Clipper, decided that he enjoyed this new game and wanted to write about it. And just as soon as having seen it, he said, you know what, we need to keep track of this stuff. There's so much happening in this game, far more than ever happened in cricket, where you hit the ball and you either run to the you either make it to the opposite wicket or you don't. Mm-hmm. So you either make an out or a run, as we now call them. But baseball was so much more complicated, with bases and outs and hit and runs and some stolen bases and walks and who knows what. Everyone argued over what was worth what matters, what type of player do you want, a guy who hits for power or a guy who steals bases. And he said, we have to keep track of everything. And that's where it really began in the 1860s and 70s, and the arguments over which statistics are best have been raging ever since.
There's a term that is absolutely crucial to the understanding of the way baseball statistics are maintained. It's a term we normally associate with accounting, but it's double entry bookkeeping, and it's absolutely vital to the game. You write in your book, the box score is a perfect illustration of double entry bookkeeping, yielding a self-contained universe as busy and as balanced as a carbon atom. Positives, fielding plays, and negatives, batting outs, canceled each other with no stragglers to upset the equilibrium. Everything was divided up amongst those responsible from the very start. Baseball's box score was, as Roger Angel would note a century later, a precisely etched miniature of the sport itself.
Yeah, well, everyone, any baseball fan has fallen in love with box scores at some point. There's just something gorgeous about looking at this tiny little encapsulation of the game and seeing, okay, who has 5-2-3-1 in his batting line? Who must have hit the game-winning double? You look at the line score to see if a team scored 4 runs in the top of the ninth to force extra innings. You can see the pitching lines. You can see the errors. The runners moved up now. As we all know, box scores have grown in the past 20 years. And it's really a beautiful little thing that allows you to enjoy something that is otherwise pretty ephemeral. You have a 3-hour game and that's that. Mm-hmm. But the box score will live forever.
There is a lot of the seismic year in baseball history was really 1910 in a lot of ways. There was a big argument over something called the Chalmers Award, which had to do with the best batter in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, they had batting average was, back then, the most important statistic. As we all know, some others have come along in the past 10 years or so to upend it. But batting average was always the mark of the top batsman in the game. And in 1910, the Chalmers Auto Company decided to award an automobile, which of course was a rather newfangled widget at the time and very prestigious, award a Chalmers automobile to the batting champion of the American League. And what people can't possibly imagine now is that back then, no one knew who the leading batter in the league was from day to day. No one kept those types of statistics. The box scores were mailed in by the official scorer to the league after each game. They sort of straggled in after a week or 10 days, and at the end of the season, they added it all up and figured out who the batting champion was. Well, at the end of the year, Ty Cobb and Napoleon Lajoie, two big stars of the day, were everyone sort of figured they were neck and neck, and the Sporting News and some other organizations tried to sort of figure out who was leading, and one person said Lajoie was up by 2 points, mm-hmm. Others said Cobb was up by three. And, well, what happened was on the last day of the season, Cobb being a rather unpopular fellow and Lajoie being completely the opposite.
Both deservedly so, let me say.
Yes, yes. Lajoie was as nice as Cobb was not nice. And so in the last doubleheader of the season, when Lajoie was playing the St. Louis Browns decided to play their infield extremely back and allowed Lajoie to bunt for, I think it was 7 or 8 hits, and he went 8 for 9 in the doubleheader, and everyone sort of figured that, hey, you know, I guess Lajoie's won, but then it turned out that Cobb had maybe had a point ahead, and 3 weeks later, the American League said, you know what, it doesn't matter, Cobb won anyway, which got them out of the controversy, but boy, were people angry that, you know, the Browns sort of laid down to help Lajoie instead of Cobb. I mean, this is a big controversy, and what's funny...
And it wasn't... go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay, but what's funny is that it was all put to rest. You know, Cobb won by a point. Okay, he got the car. Actually, they both got the car. Chalmers decided to be political and just give him to both of them. But then about 67 years later, a researcher noticed that the American League office had made a mistake and given Cobb 2 extra hits, probably on purpose, in order to avoid the controversy of Lajoie having gotten the title somewhat dishonestly. And so it's one of the great mysteries of baseball is who deserved the 1910 batting championship.
Let's get some listeners involved. What are your favorite numbers? What do they mean to you? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email totn@npr.org. Susan joins us on the line from Williamsburg, Virginia.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
The biggest vision that I have whenever I hear a stat quoted or anyone talking about it is the vision of a 5-year-old child barely able to heft the baseball encyclopedia, but knowing everything inside it and finding the most esoteric statistics and checking them out and watching the games. That child is my son. He is now 27 years old and likes them just as well now. It is the most amazing thing to me. And I always wondered, who thinks up to keep track of some of the things they keep track of these days? That fascinates me.
Well, generally, it's been fans. It's been fans who said, you know what? I think that what this player does is important. I think hitting to right field with one out is something that isn't appreciated in the game, so I think we should keep track of it. And this has been the case since the 1850s.
Well,
and it's been fans who have decided to invent all these things, basically to support the players they like.
Some of them have to have some very warped minds, I think, but it's marvelous. My 27-year-old still knows the entirety of the encyclopedia, and this is purely a hobby of his.
One of the stories that I tell in my book is how in 1969 they made the first baseball encyclopedia. To that point, there was no place you could find historical statistics like that.
Wonderful.
You know, that was the line of demarcation.
You describe it as the Oxford English Dictionary of baseball.
Amazing.
Yeah, it really was. And it's amazing the passion that people have for this stuff. I mean, there's nothing in American life, quite literally, nothing in American culture that's more closely quantified and recorded than the performance of baseball players.
Hmm.
And the census is, you know, a pretty good guess, and Nielsen ratings are based on X number of boxes, and even presidential elections, we've found out, are a little more murky than we'd thought. But baseball statistics, they have to be exact every time.
I don't know, Susan, would you like it if what you did for a living was published in the newspaper, your success rate was published in the newspaper to, you know, 3 percentage places every morning?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I'm amazed that as many baseball players as do keep themselves on an even plane, the way that they are studied, scrutinized, and otherwise analyzed. Mm. It is truly a wonder, and it's a game like no other in the world, and they have fans like no other in the world. I grew up in the Chicago area and am a diehard Cubs fan even now.
Well, good luck to you and the Cubs.
Thank you so very much. They need all the help they can get.
As always, yes.
As always. But there's always next year.
There's always next year. We're talking with Alan Schwartz. His new book is The Numbers Game, Baseball's Lifelong Fascination with Statistics. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email from Mark in Boise. Yesterday, I read in our local paper that Randy Johnson has a strikeout-to-inning ratio of 11.2 based on 4.000 strikeouts in 3,237 and one-third innings. By comparison, Nolan Ryan has the next best ratio of 9.55 based on 5,714 strikeouts in 3,844 and two-thirds innings. I do not understand how these ratios were computed. Question, how can a pitcher have a strikeout-to-inning ratio greater than 3? It appears to me that both Johnson and Ryan have a ratio slightly better than 1, and Ryan's ratio is better than Johnson's. And I think that maybe strikeouts per game we're talking about.
Yeah, it's strikeouts per 9 innings. It's possible that either he misread it or it was misprinted. Typically, one shows pitchers' performances per 9 innings. ERA, for instance, is the number of earned runs per 9 innings, and typically the strikeout records are similar. So Randy Johnson strikes out roughly 11 men per 9 innings. That's how that works.
Let's get a call now from Dan, who's with us from Carson City, Nevada.
Hi, Neil. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
First comment, my favorite statistic growing up, based on work ethic, was 162. Obviously, for the players who managed to play in every game throughout the season.
So Cal Ripken must be approaching God status to you.
Yes, it was more just the everyday player who could manage that. It didn't have to be a Cal Ripken. It was someone who could do it not year after year, but maybe that particular year.
Now, I believe Hideki Matsui of the Yankees played in 163 games last year.
Well, there you go. the asterisk players.
Yes.
The other comment, and it's interesting that you bring up Hideki Matsui, is that I applied for a job once in Japan, while living in Japan, for with the Daily Yomiuri. And I was going to write articles based on Japanese box scores. So this is basically the international language of the box score, and I couldn't read kanji, but I could read a box score, and so I basically went down to the 7-Eleven while applying for this job, and we went through the box score trying to figure out the different kanji, and we got stuck on one. It took us half an hour, me and a couple guys, at the 7-Eleven, see the Japanese kids, and it turns out that it was a squeeze play. That's what we were, kind of trying to hammer out. And I managed to write several articles based on just the box score. Exciting. The seventh inning was a really exciting inning because so-and-so-and-so did this, but it was all based on a box score.
It sounds like a lot of the reconstruction efforts your baseball historians had to go through there, Alan.
Exactly.
So, I mean, the box scores tell the stories of games in ways that, writers and video and photographs never can. It's a language all its own. It really is.
Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Good luck. And let's end with this email from Chris Duckworth in Princeton, New Jersey. The other night I wrote, I checked the Phillies box score online and jumped up and down when I noticed that David Bell had 4 hits, a double, triple, and home run, and a single. There is something about discovering such a stat in a box score prior to watching it on SportsCenter or reading it in the headlines. Needless to say, I comb through the Phillies box scores almost every day, looking for such gems before I read the headlines. I'm not alone.
Sure. I mean, I think half the fun is looking at the box score and figuring out what happened before anyone tells you. It's a little puzzle all to itself.
Alan Schwartz, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Neil. Anytime.
Alan Schwartz's new book is The Numbers Game, Baseball's Lifelong Fascination with Statistics. Starting this Sunday, he writes a biweekly column for the New York Times Sunday Sports section called Keeping Score, Looking at Statistics in Baseball. I'm off on vacation for the next 2 weeks, so let me take this opportunity to say goodbye to Leith Bishop, our executive producer here on Talk of the Nation these past 2.5 years. Leith came to us from Canada and the CBC program As It Happens. She leaves for NPR West and our sister program Day to Day. She brought us rigor, curiosity, and grace, but maybe the best way to describe her many contributions to this program is just to say that she leaves Talk of the Nation a better program than the one she found. By way of thanks, I vow to continue to cover the news from A to Z, and this musical tribute, Canadian Sunset. Ira's here tomorrow with Science Friday. Lynn Neary will be in this chair on Monday. Have a wonderful 4th of July. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.